G'day world, you're listening to Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network. This is G'day World number 271, recorded on July 31st, 2007. Very excited. My guest today is a legend in his own lifetime, Werner Vinge. And yes, that is the correct pronunciation, I know, because I asked him. Werner Vinge is a multiple award-winning science fiction novelist from the United States. Some of his best-known novels include Fire Upon the Deep, A Deepness in the Sky. He's also very well known for a novella that he wrote in 1981 called True Names, which was one of the earliest stories to present a fully fleshed-out concept of cyberspace, several years before William Gibson wrote Neuromancer and Neal Stephenson wrote Snow Crash. He also then gave a talk in 1993, which was entitled The Coming of the Technological Singularity, and it was the first person to really use that term as well. So he's a man who already in his lifetime has introduced the idea of cyberspace, the technological singularity, concepts which have become very common not only in science fiction but also obviously in our daily lives. We're talking primarily about his most recent novel, Rainbow's End, which I can highly recommend. I finished it a couple of months ago, and it's had terrific reviews, and I highly encourage anyone, even if you're not into sci-fi, you're not into the singularity, to grab a copy of this book. If you want to have a good look at what the internet and what technology and the social implications of technology may look like over the course of the next 20 years. Werner is also going to be at the upcoming Singularity Summit 2007 that's being put on by the Singularity Institute in San Francisco, California, September 8th and 9th, 2007. So without any further ado, here is my interview today with Werner Vinge.
We have a legacy of freedom and privilege which has been won by hard struggle, hasn't been given by from above. It's been won, but we have it, and we can use that to help people who are suffering seriously if we try.
Well, the singularity is a future time which will be profoundly transformative, where the machine intelligence we're creating will be billions of times more powerful than our own biological intelligence.
Well, ask you, what's next for Robert Scoble? What do you think you're going to be doing 3-4 years from now?
Oh, geez. We'll have a successful launch of Longhorn. I want to stick around with Microsoft for at least 4 more years.
Around what I call the because effect rather than the with effect. In other words, I could make more money because of my blog than with my blog.
Anything of this magnitude only happens because enormous numbers of people want it to happen and are willing to commit time and energy and money.
Well, Werner, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cameron.
Rainbow's End, I finished reading a couple of months ago, your most recent novel, and it's one of those very few books, I have to say, that I seem to be talking about everywhere I go. It comes up in many, many conversations that I have, not just with other geeks, but with friends and family, and it's one of the most inspiring books, I think, because of its depiction of the world that we're headed towards over the next 20 years. And it's had a huge response across the internet as well. I mean, when I've mentioned on my blog and in Twitter that I was going to be chatting to you today, the response has been overwhelming. I remember even Mark Andreessen in his blog recently. Did you read what he said about your book?
No.
Mark Andreessen, obviously, one of the founders of the company that became Netscape, he was talking about his top sci-fi authors, and at the end, he mentions your name as a bonus and tells everyone to go out and read True Names, the novella that forecasts the modern internet with shocking clarity. And then he talks about Rainbow's End and says he calls it the clearest and most plausible extrapolation of modern technology trends forward to the year 2025 that you can imagine. Stop reading this blog right now. Go get it, read it, and then come back. I'll wait. It's that good. We'll see how things turn out, but I would not be the least bit surprised if we look back from 2025 and say, I'll be damned, Vinji called it. Just like we look back today on 1981's True Names and say the same thing. He better write a sequel.
It was, in terms of my writing career, there are some interesting echoes there that True Names came out, True Names came out in 81, and it was probably set in 2014. And then, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, I started working on Rainbow's End, which actually took an enormously long time. Writing near future books, science fiction, it is dangerous to begin with, but you take 5 years to write it, you know, you're in danger, you're being scooped, not shortly after it comes out, but before you've even turned it in.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about writing near future sci-fi, because I find that the most stimulating, because it almost sets a challenge for what we need to accomplish in the next 20 years and gets me excited on a daily basis. But I wondered about the research process for writing a book. I mean, one of the questions that somebody in my Twitter list asked me to ask you is, how much of the technology that you predict in the book do you think is realistic, and how much of it is purely fiction?
In Rainbow's End, there were particular things that I thought were much harder to do than other things. Actually, the literal powers claimed for the contact lenses, although that was not that big of a story, it was there to add, no pun intended, transparency to the technology. that it got around, you know, head-up displays, but it did not go as far as some sort of mechanical telepathy. Nevertheless, I think that contact lenses actually would be hard technology to attain. In a broader way, though, I think that certainly the way I look at science fiction that talk seriously about the near future is that it is not, or it should not be claiming to predict where the technology is going to go. But if it's well done, it should provide a plausible scenario that one can plunk one's viewpoint down into and reason about consequences of technology. So it is true that I wrote a story that, in almost every regard, I tried to make as plausible about the near future as possible. On the other hand, considering what's happened in the last century, I would not be surprised at all if it had big clumps that turned out to be totally unliquid, but in long. That should not take away from the fact that we are talking about a scenario there. As Ray Bradbury once put it, paraphrasing, he was asked if he wrote science fiction to predict the future, and I think he said something like, "No, oftentimes I write my stories to prevent it, that is the future." And you could imagine certain sorts of scenarios may actually be self-healing, in the sense that they would alert people not to do things. In many ways, the background in the story is actually quite dystopic, for instance.
That's interesting, because you know, I don't see it as being dystopic. For me, it's a more of a utopian, a tech utopian future. Why did you see it as dystopic?
Actually, the technology in the story, for the most part, I did not regard as dystopic. I guess I could say that the negative aspects of technology in the story come about in a very mellow way. In other words, it could have been much worse. But if one reads the fine print, although it would be giving away some spoilers to to totally go into this. But if one looks at the fine print, at least in the early parts of the story, the notion of government surveillance has practically maxed out. It's very, very intense. The DRM appears to be thoroughly in place. And there's also an enormous number of things that are illegal, including even making hardware or operating systems that are essentially multi-purpose. There are things called moonshine fabs. A moonshine fab is a place where people are making organic semiconductor parts that do not have the required government logic aboard them. And then there actually is, although it's the most peaceable story I've ever written as far as on-screen violence goes, there has been clearly some pretty terrible things that have happened in the fairly recent past. The references to Chicago, for instance, in the story.
Yeah, Chicago was more than a decade past, so there's reference to some nuclear attacks that had happened. But
yeah, I think some character says, you know, we're doing pretty well. It had been more than 10 years since a major city got nuked.
Yeah. Well, I guess some people might see that as dystopian, but, I think that the extrapolation of some of those trends that we see at the moment, DRM and government surveillance, I mean, maybe this is a sad reflection, but I don't necessarily see those as being dystopic, just reality of the world that we're moving into.
In the first part, at least for most of the story, it's really imagining what is the best that those visions, which I, DRM and total information awareness are very rightly scary and intimidating. What is the most mellow way that all of that could come down?
Yeah.
And, most people in the story, in most of the world, in fact, are doing very, very well, much better than they are now. But just as in our era, there are certain overarching threats and problems, and they have their variety of those overarching threats and problems also. Actually, a minute ago, Cameron, I think you made a point I'd like to follow up on, and that is I commented that there had evidently been nuclear terrorism in the future in my story. And I think you said something, well, that doesn't sound totally dystopic. And I think that's a very realistic escape view. And it's also a good thing to compare to what folks lived through in the 20th century. In the 60s and 70s and 80s, you weren't looking at, an occasional nuclear threat to a city. You were looking at two enormous blocks of power that had sort of agreed to get together and kill 7,000 or 8,000 cities in one afternoon.
Yeah.
And that's, if a person wants to sort of, it's much scarier to think about our present situation maybe, but if you actually line up the physical threats, that MAD physical threat is much more of a racial existential threat.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess one of the challenges when you're writing a book like this, I imagine, is to think about the possibilities, the trends that could happen, not only with the technology, but with the political realities over the course of the next 20 years. And we're obviously, in terms of a singularity, I think we've been living through some sort of a social or political singularity since 9/11, where it's almost would have been impossible, I think, a decade ago to forecast the world we would be living in today in terms of the social and political realities that 9/11 ushered into being.
Well, I know that ever since I've been thinking about writing science fiction from the early 60s, I've always had this very uneasy feeling about nuclear terrorism. It was something that was generally ignored in science fiction And in a way, I don't think that was so much because leaders were not thinking about it. It was just that the longer it was that it didn't happen, the nicer that was. And after 9/11, our consciousness was focused a little bit. And myself, and I know certainly other writers, felt that talking about issues like that made a lot of sense.
Now, there's this idea of wearable computers, and one of the things that I like about the book is I think you used the term mellow before. I think this is a really easy book for me to give to friends and family and colleagues that aren't into the singularity and aren't into AI and probably would struggle to read Kurzweil and would struggle to read some harder sci-fi. But I think this is a terrific opportunity for people to start to get their head around how technology may impact society over the course of the next 20 years. One of the things, obviously, you mentioned contact lenses before, the idea of wearable computing and fine-grained, ubiquitous networking with disposable routers and cameras saturating the environment, so we have, you know, complete net coverage and viewpoints everywhere. One of the interesting things that you raise throughout the book is the issue of privacy. And one of the things that I was fascinated with by the characters in the book is how they don't seem to have much of an issue with it. And it's interesting to me today because in an era of Facebook and Second Life, more and more people have been talking to me about the aspects of their daily lives that are being exposed through these social networking and virtual worlds. Kind of arcs back, I guess, to the theme of True Names as well. How much of your real identity is exposed through your online activities. Do you personally feel comfortable with participating in the social networking and virtual world tools today? How concerned are you with the current state of online privacy?
Me personally am pathologically privacy oriented. On the other hand, there are some things a person can wish for that one is not going to get. And people talk about natural rights or God-given rights. And one thing to realize is that whether or not something is a natural right, even if it is a natural right, nature, in the case and form of technology, can take it away, and that no amount of legislation can bring it back. And my suspicion is that most privacy legislation, if it has any effect, it would be to just enforce the authority of a minority to watch the rest of us. And you're probably familiar with David Brin's Transparent Society.
Yep.
He has a book with that title, A Transparent Society.
Yep.
And there he just looks at the issue sideways. He says, well, and I'm paraphrasing and perhaps distorting, so I want him to get the credit, but I'm not claiming I'm getting it exactly the way he said it, that if technology makes privacy impossible, that is, if the coevolution between super technology, at least passive super technology, and privacy technology, if that coevolution is totally overwhelmed by the super technology, the thing to do about it may be just to go with it and look at a society where you have symmetric non-privacy. And actually, that's a topic that we can go back and forth on for a while, because obviously the question of symmetry between a government and its people is sort of fraught. On the other hand, this is something I think that very likely would ultimately work. In the short term, I think it would be very, very bumpy, because I'm not alone in being a person who values my privacy. in the longer run, I think the world would be pretty much the same way, same as it is now, except that there would probably be a lot less hypocrisy, probably fewer of the stupidest laws, and also probably, or at least hopefully, fewer of the invisible, never caught bad guys that can lurk when the shadows are deep enough.
A couple of weeks ago, I had Jemai Cassio on the show, who's with yourself, another speaker at the upcoming Singularity Summit, and we were talking about his idea of the participatory panopticon. And I think, in fact, we were talking about Rainbow's End during the discussion, which kind of, I guess, is another description of what you're talking about, where the people get to watch each other and watch the government as much as the government gets to watch them. I think he terms it surveillance instead of surveillance.
Right. And I suspect that one thing that would differentiate people in that camp, every orientation like that can be split into smaller and smaller subgroups of opinions who often fight each other worse than they do the outsiders. I think within the open society issue, there is the question of whether non-privacy is enforced or whether it's simply the absence of laws forbidding passive surveillance. And to me, that's a very, very important distinction. In other words, I don't see any reason to make laws to make it easier for technology to get into my house. But I also think that making laws to prevent people from having passive surveillance technology is just asking for another drug war and asking for a severe non-symmetry between the government and the people.
And do you think there's an opportunity for democracy of information if everybody has this sort of technology?
That's certainly my hope. In fact, one thing coming out of writing Rainbow's End, when I said at the beginning that it was a dystopia, a person has to read the whole book. There are things going on in the book that kind of reveal how, in a way, it's quite possible that it, despite all the discussion, and it doesn't matter what the laws are, if we can continue along the most important trend, and that is the trend whereby the greatest countries, the most powerful countries, come to realize that their welfare their national welfare depends on having a very large number of smart and educated and creative, relatively happy people. That more than armies, more than factories, even more than natural resources, that's the most important thing to national success. And that once that's realized, that means that some modicum of freedom has to be doled out to these people. They have to be at least fooled that there is freedom. And if you have a population that is well-educated, relatively happy, relatively well-fed, and communicating, that is, situation that we appear to be moving into, you suddenly find that the people are a very powerful force. I don't go with the 19th century and the 20th century term populism. It's not, you know, it doesn't feel like a great term. I think there is a possibility of a new form of populism when you get millions of people, and a person has to realize that tens of thousands of these people are smarter and better educated than the captains of industry and the people in the government. That when you have tens and thousands of those and millions of people who have relatively broad horizons of self-interest, they actually are a much more powerful economic and intellectual force than whatever the laws are saying. So in the end, it may well be that we have all these rather unpleasant laws about DRM and all of this stuff, and that basically the people are a powerful enough force that in a way they just let the government go on about its business and they go on about theirs, which is really the business of civilization.
Yeah, I guess we can already start to see that on a small scale, can't we? I mean, there's been, if you look at the way that, I guess, the development of the internet, the development of online, I think you call them cognitive sites and services like Google, have impacted the governments of Western countries and society in the last couple of decades. A relatively small handful of smart people have had a significant impact on the way that society and government operates.
Yeah, this was the sort of thing that when I was, you know, in a way I would say my hopes in putting together the scenario of Rainbow's End was to try to see some way through a lot of stuff that is pretty scary to the place where positive-sum gain, good results would seem more or less inevitable. And as you say, I think a lot of what's going on now fits with that trajectory. In fact, very likely it would take a major war or physical collapse, you know, to spin us back into a partitioned negative-sum or zero-sum world.
One of the other aspects of the book that I really enjoyed, because it fits in with how I'm trying to teach my six-year-old kids, is the fact that search and analysis seems to be the core skill that is taught both to the young in the book and also to the nanotech rejuvenated old like Robert. And it's sort of the heart of the economy, and it is so true today. I mean, your ability to search and find and then use relevant information is such a key skill today. How do you see the education system changing over the next couple of decades to become more comfortable with that as a truism? Because I don't know about the United States, but I assume it's very similar to Australia, where the education system is really struggling to adapt and adopt things like Wikipedia or Google.
Yes, I think that certainly is a central question, and I suspect that it is one that careful planning will have virtually no effect on the solution of. Going forward, we don't even know quite what the tools of even the next 10 years are going to be, but we do know, I think, that younger people are able to use those tools. And if they are powerful enough, then they, in a sort of emergent way, drive the game.
That I see is that if you look at what, quote, people are good for, unquote, in
you know, the ensemble of technology and people and communications, at the present time, many of the things that we used to be good at are not our central value to the system. Standing on an assembly line and making judgments and moving objects, well, the moving objects has pretty much entirely gone away. In much of the world, and in the places where hand labor is still very important, it is changing very fast, and it is very, very clever in the way that it's evolving. But there's still some role for judgment in the manufacturing, but that is sort of shrinking down. I mean, real-time judgment. So that people more and more are in a situation where it's not how much they remember. In some cases, it's not even how much they know. In many cases, it's a matter of judgment in context and being able to develop new forms of judgment quickly. So plasticity and the ability to use the tools. And so what we see is that the focus of what it is to be human is becoming much more fast-moving, and in a way it's more like a narrow spotlight
or a narrow zone of extreme creativity that's being supported by a lot of things that in the past were wholly the domain of humanity. So watching the evolution of that toward the singularity, which in this context one could almost take as a place where there is no essential human advantage, watching that evolution is fascinating, however it comes out.
Well, let's explore that a little bit more. Obviously you've written extensively over the last 40 years about scenarios involving artificial intelligence. How far do you think we are from advanced artificial intelligence as of 2007?
Rather loose bounds that I put on it in the 1993 paper, I still feel comfortable with, and that was that I'd be surprised if the singularity happened before 2005. I stand by that, and I'd be surprised if it happened after 2030. It might never happen. Although the most likely reasons why it wouldn't happen is some overarching physical disaster. So I think that we're actually very much on track with that. Now, that's an effect that is the rise of superhuman intelligence. Exactly how that happens is. In the 93 paper, I think I put down four or five paths to the singularity, which were really separate ways that it might happen. But in fact, they were spoken of separately, mainly so that I could look at them each separately. They'll probably be mixed together. And from year to year, what looks like the most likely is very likely to change. For instance, right now, the most obvious thing going on is just the combination of the network, the people on the network, and the databases and underlying computers. And that's more or less that's probably the thing that's going on in Rainbow's End. If you look at the characters there, there's an extreme from some characters who are simply extremely competent, not unlikely in a melodrama, but they're extremely competent because really technology allows it. To people that are arguably a little bit more competent than any human has a reason to be, legitimate reason to be, and then there's some characters we never meet that look like they may be still more so. So right now I think a lot of people would feel most comfortable or most likely with the singularity notion that it's just going to grow out of the network, a sort of general evolution of the whole thinking world. But I think another of the standard models is the individual or tightly networked computer. And we're entering an era now with massive parallelism in which there could be some extraordinary surprises. And so it's quite possible that in 5 or 6 years, the success of certain of those techniques and those surprises is going to be regarded as the most likely path. So while I'm pretty much happy with the timeline that I've talked about in the past, I am just as much up in the air as I ever was about which particular approach is going to get us there first.
What has surprised you the most over the last 20 years?
Let me tell you a couple intense surprises. I would hesitate to call them the most surprising because by themselves they're not too big. But there are cases where if I'd been interviewed at the wrong time, I would have and had been incautious, I would have said things that sounded very foolish later on. And that is, for instance, when did Google burst upon the scene? 98, 95,
90,
97?
Yeah, 97, 98, they really started to emerge.
If someone had asked me then about some of the things that Google could do in the time frame we're talking about by the year 2000, or excuse me, in the time frame the interviewer would be talking about, which would probably be the year 2000, I probably would have said something, well, like, let's sit down and do some arithmetic and look at how much stuff that humans have done overall, and can you really imagine server farms that could handle that? And I think if I hadn't done the arithmetic myself, I very likely would have said something incredulous about the degree of fine power that we see now, not just in Google, but in a lot of these. That's one, I would call that an intense mini surprise and a very pleasurable one. Another one is, in a way, maybe more important even, and that is the canonical complaint against Wikipedia, especially in the early days, was that wonderful idea that it is. In other words, this cynic would be agreeing that it's a wonderful idea, agreeing about the power of the people, but the cynical complaint would be that there will always be vandals, and vandals can be powered by technology, and there's no way this could work because some people are smart and they also love to be spoiled, so this couldn't work. And the fact that it is as robust as it is, and it has worked as well as it is, as it has worked, is such, for this cynic, such a wonderful surprise. And it actually speaks to one of the existential threat issues, and that is something that I first saw chillingly articulated by John Brunner in Stand on Zanzibar or Jagged Orbit or something like that. It's one of those novels in which he made the point that we're in a race here between planet-busting weapons and their expense, on the one hand, versus the number of maximum vandals. I mean, people who basically really are want to blow everything up. And despite MAD, the mutually assured destruction strategies, which were an enormous and unknown risk in the 20th century, we managed to get through that. Partly, perhaps, because these weapons were confined to the hands of very, very, very restricted places, and none of those guys apparently turned out to be really crazy. Now we're in a stage where smaller groups have weapons. What happens, John Brunner said in, I think, Jagged Orbit, what happens when anybody who's having a bad hair day can take out Australia? How long would civilization last in that case? And the experience with Wikipedia certainly does not answer the extreme version of the question. That is, you know, if world-busting weapons could be bought for $19.95 at a drugstore, but it really says something nice about, you know, the overall level of nastiness and how it can be accommodated and still get extraordinarily good results.
Still, you know, I know people have been messing with my Wikipedia page over the last month, and it can take several weeks for somebody, usually me, to go in and correct the deliberate fabrications. A couple of weeks is a bit too late if somebody decides to nuke Australia.
That's a good point. I think that first of all, I don't claim that Wikipedia protects us from John Brunner's overall point. It is a pleasant surprise in the general same topic area. The other thing, as you point out, if you, a particular person, gets maimed by this sort of behavior, then there may be still people around the general public that says, well, on average, this is working super. And that doesn't help too much individuals who get run over. Mm. And so this may be a case where I am too optimistic. On the other hand, as an answer to the original question, I think I stand by it, because I would not have thought that even in the mean, that is on average, things could work out this well.
But you're a big supporter of free and open source software. I know that you've been participating with FOSS for quite some time. So, you know, the paradigm of swarms of people coming together and contributing to the common good seems to be playing out successfully across this field, doesn't it?
In a rather regimented way, that was what showed up in Rainbow's End and the underground that also showed up in Rainbow's End. Looks like it also partakes of that. It's certainly my hope that certainly my belief that the most likely way to get through the 21st century, which actually looks like a pretty dangerous place, is by trusting in an educated and communicating humanity that is operating at a high enough standard of living that the people as a whole a clear idea of what they're up to and the fact that they have some overall commonality of goal.
And do you see that more technology enables more education, more control by the people of their destiny?
Absolutely. I and lots of other people can make good arguments about why technology can destroy humanity. On the other hand, it's pretty clear that without technology, the outcome is for humanity is essentially certain and negative. So I think we are stuck with technology, if a person wants to put it that way. But I think that the sorts of things that we're talking about here are the ways that technology can be used to protect itself and to protect us from it, and to get the enormous wins that are present in technology. I think that none of us have a concept of how much good ultimately can come out of the use of technology. We're pretty clear on how bad things can get, but that the positive end is really not appreciated, and there's very little upper ceiling.
I remember reading some quotes from Ray Kurzweil a month or two ago when he was talking about climate change and global warming and how he personally thinks that Al Gore's got it all wrong, that by 2030 technology will have solved all of these problems anyway and we'll be able to re-engineer at a molecular level the atmosphere or pollution on the planet and take care of it all. It was I don't recall there being much reference to climate change or global warming in Rainbow's End. Did I miss that? Or was it something you
there
just...
There actually was a little bit. There, at one point, there's this internal security raid going on. Essentially, there's internal security raids going on all the time. It's sort of like in the old days how Strategic Air Command bombers used to fly toward the North Pole and then turn around as long as there wasn't a war. In Rainbow's End, there are essentially flying raids that are kind of almost underway at all times. And in the briefing session for one of those, they were remarking about West Coast USA, West Coast North American threats. And one of them is... It's just one line, and I think it's something about riots in Pacific Islander settlements in Alberta.
Okay, nice. Subtle, but nice.
There may be some other references too, but it is also true that there are some things. One thing I decided to do was to, although the tone of the story has much of the same threat level as we experience today, and if a person looks at things like Chicago, there's clearly some of our worst fears materialized, but there's also some threats or current problems that just appear to be off the table. And if a person reads very carefully, one can even see evidence of resolution, or at least a shifting of the ground rules.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about YGBM, You Gotta Believe Me technology. Explain to the audience what YGBM is in the book, and I'd like to know a little bit about where you were coming from with that.
YGBM, acronym, as you say, for You Gotta Believe Me, is a MacGuffin in the story related to the possibility of technologies whereby one can sort of do an end run around all the other issues and simply make your opponents believe whatever you want them to believe, or do whatever you want them to do. And certainly this has always been one of humanity's great and darker dreams, and in a way we actually have lots of powers in those directions. I mean, advertising, propaganda, and more direct unpleasant things can all do a lot, change a person's mind about what is going on. In fact, advertising it may oftentimes be actually alerting people to the truth. And so in that case, it's unclear whether there's anything coercive about it at all. But in the story, the notion is that there are people working very hard at remote methods of making large numbers of people or individuals do what is desired by the perpetrator. And in fact, I think I have a relatively credible mechanism in the story that allows a person to get that sort of control with the finesse and delicacy of an email address, and either in broadcast form, that is 100 million people at once, or targeted on a single individual. That is a MacGuffin that would justify enormous and extreme responses on the part of nation states that felt threatened by it. And some of the countries in this story figure that that is what the USA is secretly doing in the story, that causes them to behave in to go into espionage mode, even though they have been friends with the USA for a long time.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the implicit threats of technology that is very hard for me to determine. And we're kind of used to mass media being used for the tools of propaganda increasingly over the last 40 or 50 years. And authors like Noam Chomsky have written about it extensively in Manufacturing Consent and titles like that. But the use of the internet and technology to take that to a new level is something that I think is a threat that isn't well understood yet by most of us.
Right. I think that actually there are some threats like that are underappreciated. Just the spread of ubiquitous fine-grained distribution. The networking of the embedded processors, to me that is another type of threat, since very few people have cars now that could run if their computers stopped working. And when you think about that, it's almost as though we have developed a single failure point, namely the embedded systems that we have. That, by the way, that I don't mean to say that's like that is why IBM is a separate threat, but there are, I think, disastrous surprises there lurking out there that actually live within some of our brightest hopes, namely the very bright hope of the internet and us being able to use the internet to coordinate and cooperate, and the enormous economic win that embedded micros and the transformation of moving parts technology into software technology, the enormous economic win that is there. Both of those advances have these unmeasured but possibly enormous threats within them.
I want to close just by talking a little bit about awareness of the coming era of advanced AI and of the technological singularity. You know, you have been talking about this stuff for as long, if not longer, than anybody. Certainly in the last 5 years, I've noticed a sizable increase in general awareness. I mean, if I was talking to somebody about the singularity a decade ago, when I did, people would look at me like I was trying to tell them that the aliens had landed and the lizards had taken over. Today, there seems to be a much broader awareness of the issues, even if people don't necessarily think about it on a daily basis. What have you seen in terms of understanding, adoption, public interest in the issues of where technology is going to lead us in the next two or three decades? Are you finding that it's increasing exponentially?
I do find that more and more people who have a general interest in science, also have been expose these ideas and understand these ideas, and I think that Ray's books have really helped that. That lots of people really are in tune with this. I think it's the sort of thing that makes more and more sense as we go forward, and one looks at Moore's Law and considers what the implications of that are beyond the coolest gadget that we're going to get next week. So I would expect that interest and knowledge of the singularity will grow and grow towards saturation within humanity until, for instance, it happens, or some terrible physical disaster happens that makes it that people don't aren't around to think about it anymore. In fact, I suspect that even if it doesn't happen, that actually it will become a permanent trope and point of argumentation for the indefinite future. So it's one of those things that's in the landscape. It's going to be, as a notion, it becomes more important, and moving in on possible times when it happens brings it up to the level of policy interest of serious people. Now, once it does happen, then there's questions about the nature of it that would kind of really determine the way people or post-humans look at it.
A couple of final questions. Second Life, do you spend much time in Second Life?
I've been in Second Life, and I have been following it. I haven't been there a lot.
What do you think of virtual worlds like Second Life?
I think virtual worlds, the idea of virtual worlds is something that is now at a time in which it ought to be possible to make the thing be a commercial success. I'm sure that if I were the person trying to make it happen, I would be one of those people who did so many things wrong that I wouldn't be the successful person. But I think the potential is there on the fairly near time scale for it to be a big success. I think there's a lot of aspects to it that can be commercially very helpful and actually can make a difference in society. I think that the in the near term or the medium term, that one aspect of it that could come to dominate is the mixed aspect. That is the notion that you take augmented reality and localizers and local knowledge, and you meld that together with the visual stuff that you can get through the virtual worlds. In other words, if say you were a building inspector, that there's one aspect of the virtual world that you're very interested in, and that is the blueprints of the building that you're inspecting, and that's, you would like to have that as your sort of second vision when you walk around in the building. On the other hand, another person who was a caterer or something like that would be interested in all sorts of supply flows, and their only interest in the utility core of the building to find out where to store things and where the air conditioning was, perhaps, and things like that. So that we get this sort of leakage of cyberspace into the real world. And earlier in this program, we've been talking about how people participate to make things coordinate and to make things go right. When you can combine that sort of participation and coordination with a virtual world that's actually melded in with the real world, then it's sort of like having a crowd of angels on your shoulder every time you go into a situation. And so I think that sort of notion of cyberspace leaking into the real world is plausible and could lead to a superhuman situation. It is one of the paths to the singularity. It's sort of intelligence amplification scheme, a little bit different than the usual flavor, but quite plausible.
Which is one of the most exciting aspects of Rainbow's End, people walking around with their own augmentation. One of the bits that I always talk to people about is there's a slight reference to the fact that architecture seems to be a thing of the past in the book, because people people just create the buildings that they want to see on top of a very plain block kind of construction.
Right.
And, you know, that merging of the real world and, avatar-based overlay is already starting to happen. I think the current edition of MIT's Technology Review magazine has an interesting article by Wade Roosh about how Second Life and Google Earth are being merged to present something
exactly
like that.
That was a cool article.
Well, Werner Vinge, thanks very much for spending some time chatting with us. Congratulations again on the book. I know it's been nominated for Best Novel in the 2007 Hugo Awards, which are being voted on, I think, at the end of August in Japan. So good luck with that.
Thank you.
And I look forward to reading your next masterpiece when it comes out. When's the next book due to come out?
I think it's going to be a while, but it's actually being intensively worked on. It's a Times World sequel to A Fire Upon the Deep.
Which has been much anticipated, I know, so I'm looking forward to reading that one when you finally get it out. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Okay, thank you, Cameron.